Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a podcast born out of the shock and surprise that, according to a report published earlier this year, that only 11% of women currently hold the title of creative director within the media industry. As an artist and creative director myself, I'm not oblivious to the inequality, which, let's face it, is rife in most industries, and spurred on by the 2018 Create Your Futures event, which challenged those attending what they would do to address the imbalance, the concept for Greater Than 11% was born. The ultimate aim is to contribute to significantly increasing that very small percentage. Having reflected for some time over the potential reasons as to why, across the board, there is such a disproportionate number of women to men in creative roles, I arrived at the fact there is a lot of careers that I have absolutely no idea what they are or actually what skills they require. So the possibility to inhabit or aspire to have those roles can never eventuate. I should also say here, there is of course many other factors that contribute to inequality, misogyny being quite a significant one. As I'm super interested in how others shape their creativity, I'll be chatting to a range of women over the series, exploring their careers and their creative lives, in the aim to expand the knowledge of the vast number of options available for pursuing a creative career, in addition to shedding some light on what others do. Today I'm joined by Maria Petridis in Cyprus, where summer still continues with a scorching temperature of 33 degrees. Maria is an independent writer whose practice includes poetry, art and fiction, and she has won a number of awards for her writing. She's also one of the co-founders of Picnic, an artist collective that brings together various practices of research to facilitate collaborations between artists, writers and curators. Since 2012, Picnic have made and performed and exhibited works in numerous locations throughout Europe. Maria also works closely with artists, shaping language to describe their practice and work. Her talents also extend to translation of text between Greek and English. She has been a contributor on arts and culture for Eurozine. She has been on the advisory committee for the art acquisitions for the Ministry of Culture and Education for Cyprus for the past 4 years. She has studied, lived and worked in Athens, New York and London, and now resides in Limassol, Cyprus. Maria, welcome to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I thought we would kick off with you telling me, what is an independent writer? What does a typical working week look like, if there is a typical working week?
Yeah, I would start by saying there isn't a typical week, because it always does depend on what comes up and when it comes up in terms of invites to actually write. So the independent part of being a writer, I guess, has to do with a kind of withdraw a little bit of a systematization towards how regulated your writing gets to be. And of course that has its pros and cons. It's good, it gives you a lot of space to make the choices that you make and to have time to actually research who your employers are, which is an important part of how I choose to be a writer to some extent. On the other hand, there is a challenge there in terms of the rhythm you can actually keep up with and how often you get to write and how busy you can and keep yourself meanwhile. So I think the independence part comes with a different programming of how to be a writer in a freelance world, basically.
And so typically how do you people find you, or how do you find potential projects?
A lot of that happens through networking. Cyprus is kind of a smaller place, so that happens more easily. If you're liked, of course, it works for your benefit. So a lot has to do with social networking, being in social spaces, talking with people, circulate the way you circulate your work, social media, social forums. And also ways in which you expose yourself, I guess. So either via press or via institutions.
So I know you kind of touched on it kind of when you started, but what would you say the key difference between being an independent writer is and a writer as such? Because obviously that can take many forms.
I think something that was important for me in kind of deciding not to look to write more systematically for newspapers or magazines or online magazines was a really weird space in which I wasn't sure if I could easily be comfortable with my own political positions, affiliations, independence, and so, like, not adopting a specific, I guess, point of view that could happen, doesn't necessarily happen, over a longer time of being committed to a particular institution or forum, I think, was one of the main drives for me to be more of an independent writer rather than affiliated with a magazine or a newspaper.
And so how did you arrive at that position? So obviously that's probably been quite a journey, because you obviously at some point probably were working for an organisation on a kind of regular basis or...
Yeah. I'm not sure how I got there. I think it kind of happened naturally, organically. Uh-huh. I'm not sure it was a decision that I woke up to on such a conscious level. I grew into it, I guess. I was also part of the blog era, so that was big. Okay. Late 90s, in New York especially, when I was still living there. Mm-hmm. So I kind of entered this blog space and thought, maybe this is a good place to actually make money too, because that was a possibility at the time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't very good at that, but I did give it a shot. Yeah. And I still like my blog. It's active. It's not as regular as it is for others, but... it's a place of freedom. It's another networking space that offers different places, meeting places for different voices. So I think that was a transition for me, like doing more also online writing, mm-hmm. Which was new for the 90s, mm-hmm. Rather than thinking always of publishing as something that has to happen in print, mm-hmm. or what the different values are there between print and digital publications, basically.
Mm-hmm. Could we talk a little bit, you mentioned New York, but you've also, I know that you studied in both London and New York, you've also kind of lived in Athens, New York and London, and you've written, mm-hmm. so, you know, obviously New York and London are English, and then obviously Athens and Cyprus is Greek, and you're using both languages, and maybe we can talk a little bit about what you studied and kind of that journey from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the experience is very different coming from a more Anglo-Saxon world to a Greek one, with very different cultural connotations and social experiences. I think a big part of me was formed, even though I was at an older age, as some would say, 20-something, when I was in the States. I think I was very much formed there in many ways, and had a lot to do with my studies, my background there, and just the experience of living in New York at a good time.
And you were there for a chunk of time, weren't you?
For almost 10 years, yeah. This is before 9/11 as well, so this was the golden ages, as some would call them, of New York. And London kind of came straight after New York, so there was a kind of natural flow into another Anglo-Saxon world, which was interesting but strange at once for me. But I've always kind of had an interest and inclination towards Greece and Cyprus, actually, and it was always a way to be connected to these two places when I was still in New York. Of course, that's a whole different experience from actually living in a place rather than just visiting. Mm-hmm. But I think the process of adapting was challenging, moving from London to Athens and then from Athens to Cyprus, and now just being more or less based here but moving around quite often, temporarily that is. The transitions are challenging. Mm-hmm. The switch in language is also challenging. Mm-hmm. So you have a language in which you write, which is different to the language that you speak in every day. And then culturally, it's also different to a typical experience, if you like, everyday quotidian experience in Cyprus. So that does require kind of a critical space almost in which to negotiate those two languages.
Yeah, I guess as well. I mean, I speak French, very bad French. Mm. But, you know, when I was studying French and living in France, that shift of thinking in one language and shifting to another is actually a really manual shift. Like, languages have different, you know, possibilities. And I know speaking with friends here in Cyprus, you know, mm-hmm. Eleanor constantly says, mm-hmm. oh, I wish I could explain this to you in Greek mm-hmm. because it's so much more mm-hmm. detailed than mm-hmm. what it is in mm-hmm. English. Mm-hmm. And I guess you're shifting between these two kind of modes of communication and expression and creativity. Mm-hmm. So how do you do that? Because you're working in both constantly.
I think it's still a work in progress for me. I might be getting better at how I am mm-hmm. With the Greek language, which is also a very different language to the English, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I predominantly write in English, and of course that allows me a comfort zone to some extent in which I can perform mm-hmm. In a way that I feel more comfortable. On the other hand, because I'm more oral with the Greek language, it gets developed more in that department rather than the writing part mm-hmm. of it. And that, I think, is something I'm always in a progress, work mm-hmm. in progress with.
So how do you, in your practice, start separating those strands? Do you need to separate them, or do they kind of bleed in and inform one another?
Yeah, that's actually a nice observation. There are times when they do all of those wonderful things that you just said. They do bleed into each other and they connect very well. And one does definitely inform the other in ways that might not even be conscious at the time that they're happening. A lot of times there's an intuitive kind of feeling that merges things together when even before the thinking process of what you're actually doing happens. I can't explain why that happens, but it does, and it's wonderful when it does. But they're also very different practices and very different exercises. I consider all of those at least three: translation, editing, writing, fiction, or reviews. Very different creative processes. Mm-hmm. Even when editing, especially, might at moments kind of feel more like it's technical, it can be, mm-hmm. depending on what the material that is being edited is. There's also, you find different layers in which you can be creative, which I like. They're not very visible at times. Mm-hmm. They're certainly not visible because they're outside the sphere of what authorship would be containing. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of work that gets put into it, which to me is exciting. It's a different way of focusing on something. Mm-hmm. A lot of times focusing on material that you're less familiar with gives you a different perspective on how easily you take for granted what you think you know in a different department. So I like that kind of challenge and everything that has to offer. And in the department of translation, I think this ongoing negotiation of at least two languages, and of course the language that you speak and the language you think in might not always be the same one. So this kind of metaphor of actually translating has a lot of space, a creative space in it, besides contextualizing what the semantics might be in the text that you want to offer a kind of a more authentic translation of what's being said and meant. There's a lot of space in terms of how you choose to do that, mm-hmm. And the kind of rhythms that you allow and intonations and colors that you bring out. So it's a different process. And the two, editing and translating as opposed to writing, are less lonesome experiences. Mm-hmm. So there's always a time when you're in relation or in contact with at least one other person, mm-hmm. which changes the dynamic mm-hmm. in how you experience the text itself.
Mm-hmm. Just listening to you talk now, I was just thinking about translation, actually. It's a hugely empathetic act, mm-hmm. actually. You mm-hmm. have to really... Mm-hmm. like get into the text, feel it, you know, breathe it, like it has to touch all the emotions.
Yeah.
That must be quite, not disclosable, but it's a lot of work emotionally, psychologically, mentally. How does that work? Do you have a process around that when translating, like mm. reading the text, thinking about how it can then be changed into another language?
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. Because especially with Greek and English, they're very different languages in terms of the degree of emotionality that you suggested that comes out, and that is another process of negotiation. English can often be very antiseptic clear and very well defined and specific, and Greek can often be very much about exaggeration and paradox and a lot of other wonderful things that wouldn't sound right in another language.
I think from an observation from the outside, yeah, it requires like a huge degree of sensitivity.
And again, there's a lot of work, as with editing, a lot of work in translating that is invisible. And a big part of that is the research that you, depending, of course, on what you're translating and how long the text is, whether it's a book, an article. But even in shorter texts, with in the case of articles or even prose, you always need a wider context, even when it's not there. So you have to look for it, and you have to look at it for it in places that seems to you to make sense in relation to what the author wants to say and do. And that's a lot of work that can go on very long tangents that you have to come back from. So, but it's also a big and nice part of that kind of work. I enjoy it very much.
In terms of your creative practice for your own work, so your art, poetry, and fiction writing, what is that process? How does it kind of start? How does it start to form, and then kind of how do you follow it?
Sometimes it forms by not being formed at all. They could be very disjointed, fragmented ideas. A lot of times I work with notes that I take, and they could be notes that are jotted down at very awkward moments at places where I could be doing something very relative to writing. And then I come back to it, and I come back to it at different times in my life depending on what I'm thinking about during that period. I'm very much influenced by what's around me, what happens around me, what I'm responding to, if I'm responding to something enough. And I often like to find ways in which to respond to social issues, to issues that are problematic, to unsolved issues through my writing. So I'm not sure about what the form is each time. I think it does depend on what it is that I'm writing and if I have a more specific audience or not in mind, because that also varies depending. And then again, if I'm writing in a way that's already directed for publication somewhere or not, again, that influences a little bit.
So can you talk to me now about Picnic? And I should say that Picnic is spelled P-I-C-K-N-I-C-K.
That's right.
Just in case anyone wants to find it. So what it is, how it came about, how it works.
Yeah, so we're an artist collective, research and art collective, and there's three of us, Alkis Hadjiandreou, Panayotis Michael, both visual artists. We're also very good friends. We kind of re-met in Cyprus at a particular time when the three of us, myself and Alkis, had moved back to Cyprus or moved here indeterminately, and started observing a little what's happening in Cyprus, what isn't happening, the gaps, the black holes, all those things that should be happening or could be happening and aren't. So there was a lot of problematization on that level of just sitting down and chatting and having a conversation as friends and pointing out things and wondering about them. Picnic happened as a need, and it was a very direct one of creating a space in which we felt much more comfortable, in which we could develop our projects and our ideas. So I guess that's how we started, with lots of questions that we're still answering, observations, and also reactions. We try and create different ways of doing art, and one of those is to create an audience kind of contact. So where there may not be audience, or maybe where we would like to produce a different type of audience, or just really engage with one. We use different tactics. One particular project, I think where this is more clearly demonstrated, is Do Delay. We made a nice selection of different visual video artists, international. And what we did is we had a walk in the old town of Nicosia over a span of a few weeks, and where we we literally walked in the city very randomly without pre-announcing particular times and days in which we would screen these videos, but actually, a bit like doodling in a sketchbook, we projected them on walls. And we kind of entered different spaces in which to do that, and just left the space open in terms of how people engaged, who engaged, when people wanted to engage, and what that looked like. So to some extent, there's a degree of risk, in the sense that we're not always very sure about the direction of where our projects go. We keep them open. Our collaborations are a very important part of how the projects diverge and how they contribute to the overall concept. So we're generally open in our ideas and approaches, and inviting to work with people, because we do think that collaboration is a big part of how art production could be moving these days, especially, and creating more possibilities for inclusion.
Okay, so in terms of you being a writer, an intended writer, what's been one of the biggest challenges kind of in your career that you've had to face?
The kind of solo experience of being a writer. And I think that had a lot to do with me wanting to be with Picnic. So, and also my choice of writing with the arts, with artists, requires a lot of conversation, interaction, observation, engagement. So I think being away from that kind of stereotypical image of the writer in a room, coffee after coffee, typing away on a computer, it can be very disconnecting. Although there's probably never a moment where we are totally disconnected from other lives on online or wherever they are around us. But I think what I was interested in transitioning into was not actually experiencing that process alone. Of writing, whatever it is, the process of actually doing the writing, and allowing that to be affected by other parameters outside myself, I find to be interesting. It's not typical for a writer to acknowledge a lot of times what goes into the writing. Picnic had a lot to do with me wanting to allow different influences into my writing, and vice versa. And also crossing disciplinaries, so seeing what kind of spaces those disciplines open into, and how my process of allowing myself to be open might also be a stepping stone for creating that in with other collaborators, with other worlds of collaborators.
Would you say that you kind of had a moment where you sat down and thought, actually, you know, writing can be quite isolating, I can be in this situation, how do I broaden it out, how do I make connections, how do I have conversations, dialogue that feeds into the work and vice versa? Was that kind of something that you arrived at, or was that more of a process? Because it's, for me, it's a really clear vision, and actually it's being enacted, and it's what you do on a daily basis now, and that's what makes you an independent writer.
Yeah, it was a process, I think. I mean, I remember my first kind of contact with being more conversational about writing was when I was working as a student during my first degree at City College of New York in New York, at the Writing Center. And I loved this job. It was a very, very underpaid job, but I loved it. And I loved that I was in this space where it was so particularized. So it was about, you know, bringing your papers that needed working on to the Writing Center, surrounded by this library and a great environment where people actually talked in this space. And so the kind of conversations that would happen there had a lot to do with changes that would happen eventually in the papers. And there were times when they would be followed through, so I would see the same students again, and there were times when that wouldn't happen, so I wouldn't know what the result actually was. And that was also interesting as an experience for me. But I also, at that time, liked that kind of interaction that happened, and happened with the other person, with the text, in a very close kind of engagement.
So how do you personally like nurture your work?
A lot of reading, a lot of online reading too. A lot of crossing with different people in different disciplines, actually. A lot of times I'm informed. It's not always a conscious decision. It doesn't happen at the time as a thought process in a very structured way, but it does. It is something that happens anyway. The work that I edit can also bring to me different ways of seeing things that I wouldn't have done mm-hmm. from a kind of art, a writer's perspective. So I do a lot of editing in education, science education, mathematics education, semantics and semiotics. I'm an editorial assistant for a volume by Cambridge Scholars Publishing on semiotics and visual communication. So a lot of different areas give me different tools in some ways to think about, not so much that they're tools to be applied.
So just thinking about, this is kind of coming left field, but kind of thinking about, and it's just struck me that you've got so many kind of streams of writing and differently, as we talked about shifting gears and kind of, how do you find your motivation and then also the discipline? Because you've got lots of things going on at any one time. And you have to self-organise.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I'm not always good at that. I do work with with deadlines a lot. And so sometimes that terrible pressure of just having to handing something works. It can work positively too. Some people work better with pressure, some people less. It's not always consistent, but it could be a framework. The time framework can also be a framework to actually get something done. Again, there's a lot of invisible work, and I kind of insist a lot on this term because it is a big part of what I do. Like finding ways to material or forms of nurturing is also another one of those processes. And it happens, you know, some days more productively than others. I try not to be online for too long. I like to contain that part, and I'm
before
also
you fall down a hole. Basically.
Yeah, and I'm also not a very avid reader online. I work on the screen for too long, so I don't always want to read on the screen either. And I do like to sit with a book, and it feels very different in company. I think I stretch out into different areas to look for that kind of nurturing, whether it's to other writers, different forms of writers, very different things that I wouldn't ordinarily read about.
If someone is wanting to be an independent writer, kind of what advice would you give? Kind of what do they need to know? Kind of, you know, as I just talked about, being self-organized, finding the motivation. Mm. Kind of what would your advice be?
Yeah. I think I would say don't be afraid of it. You know, there's a certain degree of a kind of misinformed, imposed a sense of a precarity in the days in which we live. And I'm more for it. And I do think that we can strengthen ourselves better in different ways if we're not entirely dependent on freelance work to always pay the bills. That is a challenge, and it is a very understandable it's an understandable reason to actually divert someone away from it, I guess. But I think there are ways in which you can grow independently as a freelancer. There's a lot to discover and a lot to be discovered in having that kind of freedom. It definitely is a big gift. I enjoy it very much. I would encourage it. See where it takes you. And then you can always not be a freelancer if you don't want to be. That happens too. You know, it could be a place where you just want to walk through and then see where it goes. And if you find a better place that you want to stop at for a longer time, then you go for it. Mm-hmm. So.
And if you are going down that freelance independent writer kind of route, kind of, what would your thoughts or advice be on in terms of finding platforms or spaces for your work?
So I think looking for other people who work in similar or more different areas in freelance writing, the kind of platforms that they're working in. So networking, obviously, as is true with a lot of other disciplines, is a place where I would look. And then also just not being afraid to look at places where you wouldn't imagine you would get accepted. So go for it. Be ambitious and take the risk.
So what's coming up for you? What have you got in the coming weeks and months?
Yeah, a lot of editing that's coming actually to an end. So hopefully after that I will start having some time. I still have some ideas that are pretty vague in my head about writing a short novel, a novella. Mm-hmm. So that would be my challenge. And it will be a solo experience. Mm-hmm. but I think that I'm at a place where I feel like I want to do that now. It might be a year or 2 year project with all the great interruptions which will definitely come in between by other jobs, but maybe they'll inform the work in some ways. I'm sure they will.
So Maria, I've loved talking to you. I think I've got more questions than answers at the moment. Probably going to ask you probably when we finish a few more things, but what I do at the end of every episode is I ask firstly, is there a career or a job in the creative industry that you know little about and you've always been curious about, so that I can maybe explore that as a potential subject further on?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
And secondly, is there a woman within the creative industries, or women, that you would love to hear on Greater Than 11%?
I would love to see Gwenna Quilomba. She's a wonderful Portuguese performance artist, writer with a background actually in psychology, clinical psychology. She's worked with a lot of victims of wars. Mm-hmm. She's based in Berlin. She's associate professor at the Gender Studies Department of Humboldt University in Berlin. And I think she would have a lot to say, a lot to offer through her performance, through her writing, the way that she blends the two, to talk and research and share experiences of how to basically decolonize knowledge and to reperform it through one's own agency.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, Maria, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful. Thank you, Renee.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review on Apple Podcasts, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. And also stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haberson, and to Mary Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.